This is Death Watch, the monthly podcast where we eulogize one of the greats who has recently passed by watching some of their work that we weren't previously familiar with. My name is Matt Brown.
And I'm Matthew Price.
That's right. Two Matts. No waiting. Today we look at the career of a producer who changed not just Hong Kong cinema, but arguably by extension world cinema itself through his Golden Harvest production company and the enormous explosion of Hong Kong movies that brought into the West and everywhere. Of course, Raymond Chow, who died at the beginning of November. His films were breakaways for Bruce Lee, for Sammo Hung, for Choi Hawk, for Jackie Chan. And like I said, huge influence, even ongoing today, for Western cinema. I watched Enter the Dragon.
Yes.
You theoretically watched one of
Can
Fist
I read
of
you,
Fury.
Can I
yeah,
read
please
you
do.
The paragraph that
please
I
do.
Sent you earlier? This because
is, this is why.
This is something. So
yeah.
I thought I'll watch Fist of Fury.
Yeah.
Because I've watched Fist of Legend.
Sure.
Which is the very great Jet Li loose remake of Fist of Fury. But mm-hmm. I've never, outside of Enter the Dragon, actually have not seen any of the four of the other three Bruce Lee films.
The Bruce Lee movies, yeah.
I thought of the other three, this one sounds like the one mm-hmm. that I want to watch. So great. I go to the video store. I rent what I think is Fist of Fury, not noticing that there's an extra S that it says Fists of Fury,
mm-hmm.
thinking, how different can these be? Oh, it's a whole other movie.
Of course. Yeah.
So let me just quickly read you from the Wikipedia. Fist of Fury was accidentally released in the U.S. under the title The Chinese Connection. It gets better. This title was a means of tapping into the popularity of the French Connection.
Sure.
That title, The Chinese Connection, was actually intended to be used for the U.S. release of another Bruce Lee film, The Big Boss.
Mm-hmm. Which was his first film at Golden Harvest.
Which is his first film, which yeah. also involved drug smuggling, which is yeah. why you would want to call it
sure.
The Chinese Connection, because unlike Fist of Fury, which has no connection to mm-hmm. the French Connection, this actually
has a French connection.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
The Big Boss, which also involves drug smuggling. However, the U.S. titles for Fist of Fury and The Big Boss were switched.
Mm-hmm.
Resulting in Fist of Fury being released in the U.S. under the title The Chinese Connection until 2005,
mm-hmm.
while The Big Boss was released as Fists of Fury.
Yep.
So I watched The Big Boss.
Yeah. So you're sure you watched The Big Boss?
I'm very sure because that is what I watched.
Cool. All
there
right.
were drugs in it.
Yep.
And it was definitely the first one, and mm-hmm. we can talk about why. But
great.
That's what happened, and I stand by it.
Looking forward to it.
I'm not upset.
Yep.
I've just seen another Bruce Lee film. It's
cool.
fine.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to talk about those movies in a minute. But before we get to that,
yep.
a little something we love called Roll Call. And it's going to be, what we're going to do is we're going to do the normal roll call. And then
yeah.
we have a new roll call add-on.
We'll get to it.
We'll get there.
Don't worry. It's a significant
roll call. Whoa, do I look worried? I'm not worried.
You're sweating.
I am sweating. Yeah. Yeah,
I am. But then you're always sweating.
That's right.
Yeah.
I run hot.
That's true. Okay, let's start roll call. So it's been a pretty eventful month.
This was a big month.
Big month, lots of people. We'll start small and we'll build.
Yeah.
Dorcas Riley passed away. First of all, big fan of any woman named Dorcas.
Sure.
I just love the name. It's mm-hmm. a biblical name, in fact. But it's so funny to me that was a name that persisted until well into this century.
Yeah, until
Can
it
you
was
imagine,
finally killed
you know,
by the name Dorcas Malorcas.
Is that what killed
it? And that
it?
Is finally when everyone was like, oh, we can't call anyone this.
No, I feel like the rise of the word dork is what... anyway, not to take anything
I've,
of...
I've come to realize that I start doing a very Ed McMahon call and response to roll call, which might suggest to the listener that I don't take these deaths seriously. That is not the case.
No, you're just angry at me.
That's
I understand.
Please continue. I'm going to be very serious now.
Hey-o.
Hi-o.
That was good. Dorcas Riley was, and this is why I thought this was cool, she's significant because she worked for Kraft in the 1950s. She is the inventor of the green bean casserole, which is a staple Thanksgiving dish. It is served roughly 20 million times every Thanksgiving.
Wow.
Yeah, it's green. It's blanched green beans with Campbell's mushroom soup, and then the French's fried onions on top.
Disgusting.
It is a, well, it depends on your point of view. I just think it's so cool that someone invented a thing that then, like, mm-hmm. she invented it to sell soup, right? And then it became, yeah. So that was that. I thought a milestone in home economy.
Mm-hmm.
Earl E. Bakken, inventor of the battery powered pacemaker.
Thanks, Earl.
So saved countless lives.
Yeah,
for sure. John Ziegler Jr., who was the longtime president of the National Hockey League,
mm-hmm.
Built the league through expansion in the 1970s. Cicely Berry, who was the Royal Shakespeare Company's voice director. So her job was to teach people how to speak the words of Shakespeare.
Neat.
Some of the people she taught, Sean Connery, Patrick Watson, Judi Dench, Emily Watson, Ian McKellen.
Neat.
She's the person who taught Ian McKellen how to speak the words of Shakespeare.
Yeah.
Notozaki Shange, playwright. I apologize because I'm definitely mispronouncing her first name, and I'm sorry. She wrote a wonderful play called For Colored Girls Who Have Considered Suicide,
oh,
When the
course.
Rainbow Is Enough.
Yep.
Longtime Boston area mobster Whitey Bulger,
mm-hmm.
who was beaten to death in prison.
As you do.
As one does. Filmstruck, which was
sure did,
which was beaten to death
uh-huh.
by the stock market,
and saved me from a certain ignominy because I was suddenly found myself without a costume for our annual costume contest here at Tiff Bell Lightbox. The death of Filmstruck mere days before gave me a perfect opening. And I opened my neck and bled all over a Filmstruck t-shirt and came in second place.
It's pretty good.
Yeah, not
pretty
bad.
Pretty good. And especially second place in this joint.
Yeah, that's absolutely.
Yeah.
These people are serious about film.
Yeah. Willie McCovey, a longtime baseball great, Willie McCovey, passed away. Here's what it was down to. So Raymond Chow died this month,
mm-hmm.
right around the same time Louis Cha died. Louis Cha, so if Raymond Chow is Kung Fu, Louis Cha is Wuja.
Yes.
Right? He's a novelist. Most famously wrote the Condor Trilogy. 77 separate adaptations of his work are listed on IMDb, including my favorite, Eagle Shooting Heroes, which has both been adapted as the eponymous Eagle Shooting Heroes, which is, if you ever get a chance to see it, have you seen it?
No.
It was at TIFF many years ago, and it is bananas. It's one of the more outre Hong Kong action films of the sort of late 90s. Wire work, crazy humor, lots of goofy switcheroos of things. So that's Eagle Shooting Heroes.
Mm-hmm.
The exact same novel was adopted by Wong Kar-wai as Ashes of Time.
Right.
Which could not be a more elegiac.
Yeah. Yeah. That
right?
movie I have seen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if you have not seen Ashes of Time, see Ashes of Time.
It's fascinating.
It is great. Yeah. He also wrote Swordsman. So basically all of the sort of really sweeping, melodramatic, great stuff that came out of Hong Kong cinema,
mm-hmm.
A lot of it came from him or very strongly influenced by him.
Right.
Mario Segal, who was a Seattle landlord, physically a little rotund, had a kind of a bushy mustache, and he just owned some buildings in Seattle, including the building that Nintendo of America used to work out of.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, he is the inspiration for Super Mario.
Super Mario.
Yes.
Right on.
Yes. Was a real person. Was their landlord.
That's great.
It's kind of cool.
It's weird that he wasn't their plumber.
Yeah.
But whatever.
Yeah, there you go. Kitty O'Neill, stunt woman, worked on both Bionic Woman and Wonder Woman in the mm-hmm. 70s. In one of the only stunt performers to actually have a television movie made about her and her life. Also held the land speed record for women. The reason,
really,
yeah, the unusual. So she in the Salt Flats thing, she holds the record still,
cool,
for the fastest time by a woman. The unusual thing about her, profoundly deaf.
Oh,
so was a stunt performer without the use of hearing to assist her in timing and things like that.
Wow,
yeah, pretty cool. Douglas Rain, actor,
yeah,
voice of the HAL 9000,
sure was.
And wonderful Shakespearean actor as well.
Yeah, I saw him at Stratford in, God, I can't remember what he was in. It might have been Merchant of Venice like 15 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then let's talk about, let's take a step away here.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Stan Lee.
Yeah. Now, are we introducing a new segment here? Is that the plan?
I think we ought to.
Okay. And it is called Roll Call Honor Roll. Oh, Honor Roll Call?
It is Honor Roll Call. Not you can't do Stan Lee with me just goofing for 5 seconds about
honestly we did contemplate just making the whole show about Stan Lee. I mean, obviously the problem with that, just in terms of the structure of our show, is that there is next to nothing we haven't seen from the movie world or the TV world.
I'm not watching a bunch of episodes of Bill Bixby and the Hulk.
Sure.
And I'm for sure not watching that 1990s Fantastic Four.
Yeah.
So,
and I actually did both of those for a different podcast that I was on where we were ranking all of the Marvel-based movies. So
yeah,
I watched like the first two Captain America movies. I watched Hulk versus Thor from the Bixby show. And, you know, they're terrible.
Yeah, they're terrible.
But let's not let that be a mark against, you know, arguably one of the most influential American writers of the 20th century, Stan Lee, who, you know, again, I wrote a very quick eulogy of him for Screen Anarchy the day he died, and I did mention that, you know, we have to take some of his accomplishments, not with a grain of salt, but you need to be aware that he was collaborating with a lot of people who never got, you know, quite the accolades or the money he did. But that said, he's still got, you know, a decade and a half of sort of the most, again, one of the most influential runs in all of comics, and therefore I think all of writing, because comics became one of the pillar writing media for America, anyway, for Western culture in the back half of the 20th century. So it's very difficult to imagine things that the way they are now in a world where Stan Lee didn't exist.
Yeah, 100%. And I think, you know, even for comic book publishers that other than Marvel, it's very difficult to imagine any comic not being very heavily influenced by kind of the foundational stuff about Stan Lee, about his approach, which is that they are people with problems first, and then they happen to have superpowers.
Yeah.
So, and that approach has, you know, and there are differences in how various companies integrate that, but it's there in everything. It's not like you can't go back to a kind of more simplified version of this, the way you look at comics from the sort of 30s and 40s. You'll never see comics like that again.
No, yeah, like that whole idea of the humanizing the characters and giving them human problems, obviously, like it's inflected so much about pop culture as it continued, you know, like that. In the fantasy genre, you talk about high fantasy versus low fantasy. He was doing the low fantasy version of comics, but it just continued forever. Just became the way that you access these characters, because obviously the problem with the Silmarillion and other kinds of high fantasy is that you're generally talking about characters that have no human access point at all. So he was like, well, I mean, let's figure that out. Let's make a superhero who's a 16-year-old boy going through high school. You know, like that's significant. That's important.
I find it hard to believe that any medium, television, films of any kind, haven't at least somewhat benefited from this idea, right? That you can have a story that is about something. And I don't think Lee invented
No, certainly not.
I don't want to like overstate this, but I think this idea that he employed in comics is certainly overriding in many things. I don't think there's any question that attention to detail, that attention to character, is what separates the truly great stuff from the merely okay.
Yeah, you know? Agree.
Yeah,
and I also think, you know, I've said this in other places as well, but it's also important to note that the way he approached the fans of Marvel and the fans of his work has, I think, defined the fandom universe for what we know of it today. You know, he was writing those bullpen bulletins in every issue of Marvel for like 20 years, and he was like, yeah, you know, I'm a relatable face and voice behind this work that you, as a person who has accessed this world, you have access to me. We're on the same team. We believe in the same things. You know, like, we're all in this together. He was going to conventions until like literally last summer. You know, he was always a huge, gracious, magnanimous presence in the fan universe. And that sort of, I think, inflected the way the entire fan universe works. You know, like, that you can have that relationship with the people that consume your work, and you can be at that level of accessible to them. And that's part of how the fun gets generated, and that sense of access, that sense of belonging to a club gets grown.
Yeah. And I think part of that, too, is what comes around to kind of be a knock against him, which is that, you know, he wanted to be the only public face.
True.
Of Marvel.
Yep.
And so that the good in that is just what you talked about. The bad in that is that it would mean that he would quite often minimize the contributions of others. He also, and I think the other really significant thing about him, is the idea of the Marvel method as a way of writing, which, you know, is, I would argue, is something that you see now in things like the Will Ferrell movies and things like that. The idea that you create broad structures for your story, and then you kind of go in and fill it in with a bunch of different choices on the day, and you don't pre-plan all the dialogue, you don't pre-plan the tiny details, you just get the big pieces going, and then you come back after there's something on the page. And that's, I think, very similar to the approach that a lot of improvisational-based films take, and seems to work quite well in most cases. And you know, certainly revolutionized comics allowed him to work on so many books at once, you know, because he could, they would map out a big story arc, then just go draw it, and then I'll come back and tell you what they're saying specifically. But I just want to know roughly what's going on.
Yeah. And I mean, that's a good point, too, is just his incredible level of productivity, or at least the level of productivity to which we ascribe.
Yeah, I think at one point he's working on like 20 books.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, I mean, not till, yeah. I mean, I don't think anyone's ever hit that level again, but like, it wasn't until, like, you know, Bendis came around in 2002 and he was writing like 6 or 8 books a month that you'd even see something coming close to that level of authorship.
But part of it is that method where you could, you know, he'd get the writers to almost do some of the story work for him. You know, and then you get into that controversy of like, who really owns this?
Who really wrote this? Who really developed it? Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, we'd be remiss if we didn't point out that, you know, not directly, but that little universal brainchild of his did sort of change the way, you know, movies are made in the 21st century, because the MCU is kind of leading the charge on what it means to make popular filmmaking now.
Yeah.
And I'm sure many people feel wrongly. I don't have an opinion.
You do so.
Well, I don't really. I mean, people think I'm very like strongly MCU or strongly, you know, mega franchise, and it's like, no, I'm not. Like, I just recognize what's going on, which is that there's always a way that popular films are made. Once it was the studio system, once it was genres, once it was, you know, pop culture classics like Spielberg and Lucas, and now it's this.
Remember High Concept?
Yeah.
Well, that was good.
Yeah, High Concept was huge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I miss High Concept.
Yeah, no, we don't do High Concept anymore. No. Anyway, is that the end of Honor Roll Call?
That is the end of Honor Roll Call. Let's go back to regular Roll Call.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. So we lost Catherine McGregor. So, and you are not old enough. Did you watch Little House on the Prairie?
I mean, I do remember it
a little bit. Did you watch Little House on the Prairie?
But not much.
Yeah, I watched Little House on the Prairie. I'm a little older than you.
Yeah.
And Little House on the Prairie was just on TV. Catherine McGregor played Mrs. Olson.
Okay.
Who was the sort of evil, next-door neighbor, mean lady.
Cool.
And she's really great at it, actually,
I'll bet.
I have to say. Roy Clark from Hee Haw.
Mm-hmm.
Arguably one of the best guitar instrumentalist, period, you know, regardless of genre. If you ever, and again, I'm old enough to have watched Hee Haw growing up. I'm guessing you are not.
No, never watched Hee Haw.
There's a divider.
No.
Yeah. And Hee Haw was terrible.
Great.
Terrible.
Great.
It was everything you would expect from a 1970s variety show. But it, musically, thing was sound as a pound.
Mm.
And he was a big part of that. Another person we lost who we could do a whole show about, and in fact, I almost want to like switch back into honor roll call, but we didn't talk about it.
No, we can go back into honor
roll
call.
Well, we don't have anything prepared, so maybe we'll think about what we want to do with this. But William Goldman.
No, we can do an honor roll call for William Goldman, and why the hell not? I just haven't seen some of his, like, I still haven't seen Butch Cassidy. I think there could even be a case made that we do December.
And that's why
on
I'm
Bill
saying
Goldman.
Maybe we just
all
leave
right,
it
let's
at that.
Pause the honor
let's
roll
pause
call.
The honor roll all call. Right. We may come back to it.
Yeah.
But William Goldman,
yeah.
Screenwriter, novelist,
yep,
brilliant. Human said the most accurate three words ever about Hollywood and the idea of the of show business,
mm-hmm.
which is nobody knows anything, which is to me the greatest thing anyone has ever said about
sure.
the business. Right?
Yeah. In a weird bit of incidental timing, I had just rewatched The Princess Bride for Screen Anarchy. 3 days before he died.
Oh, the Criterion.
Yeah,
yeah. yeah.
So that
yeah.
review is in our Twitter feed somewhere.
Nice.
You can go find that. But yeah, it was just like it was such a weird week to be. And the, maybe even weirder, the best special feature on that disc is about him and his writing.
Of course.
You know, so I was just
yeah,
like,
and along
wow.
with, you know, I guess Robert Towne and who else? Like there's very few
no.
sort
yeah.
of like really preeminent screenwriters.
For sure.
Yeah.
yeah.
Okay, so yeah, William
yep.
Goldman. Pablo Ferro.
Mm-hmm.
Brilliant title designer.
Yeah.
First credit is Dr. Strangelove.
That's the way to do it.
That is. Those are some great.
Yeah.
The titles are great in that. But also Thomas Crown, Bullet, Thomas Crown Affair, Bullet, Midnight Cowboy, Bound for Glory, Clockwork Orange, Harold and Maude, Being There, Beetlejuice, Married to the Mob, Men in Black, and The Addams Family. And that's, I'm scratching the surface.
Nice work.
yeah. Yeah.
Nice work, Pablo.
That is pretty great. And then last note on this week's or this month's roll call, Myra Langdon Reisman, who was the founder of filmscouts.com, which is arguably the first movie fan website on the internet.
Is that?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Precedes Ain't It Cool, all of the other old-time sites, is still pretty much intact. If you go to filmscouts.com now, you'll see basically the website from 20 years ago.
Neat.
Yeah, with like a few more modern articles. But basically it was a website that was meant to look like a movie theater. The articles were in playing in various theaters.
Oh.
You would like click it. It was very cute.
Man, we really had no idea what we were doing back
none.
Then.
None.
Yeah.
None. Anyway, Film Scouts started, you could argue, started the idea of this internet two-way relationship with movies.
Right.
And died quite young. In her early 60s.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right. I mean, that was roll call. And yeah, it was kind of a big month. And we're recording this about 10 days earlier than you're going to hear it. So, I mean who knows where
God
we're going
to
be by the time
yeah,
this thing
yeah.
drops.
Yeah.
So before we get into the movies, we'll just do a real quick bio on Raymond Chow. He's of Hakkahan ancestry, from whence the greatest food on the earth comes. He studied journalism when he was in school. He also studied, of course, martial arts.
Oh, he did?
He did, apparently.
Cool.
Yeah, that's what Wikipedia says. So his film career started, he was the head of publicity and production for Shaw Brothers between 58 and 70. So, you know, Shaw Brothers, obviously like the going concern in cinema in Hong Kong
right.
at the time. And then in 1970, he leaves with Leonard Ho to set up their own thing, Golden Harvest,
yes.
which became Shaw's major competitor. So he learned from what he considered to be the mistakes at Shaw Brothers, which he felt they didn't give enough creative control. They were too templated. They kind of boxed everyone in. So they were like, we're going to make deals with stars and directors. We're going to let them do their thing. And off we go. Obviously, a huge part of their success is that they signed Bruce Lee as he's in the process of breaking out as a huge star. A weirdly huge star for someone who really made five movies. But, you know, they go out the gate in 71 with The Big Boss, which I guess is the movie that you watched.
It was.
Yeah.
Turns out it was.
Yep. And then they lead the Hong Kong box office for the next 2 decades.
Yeah.
So that whatever they did, that worked. So from the 70s until recently, they were producer on all of Jackie Chan's films. Which was, again, one of their largest assets in their stable. They produced Cannonball Run, which we discussed last month. How strange.
It was. Yeah, it is really strange that he passed away.
Very odd.
Yeah,
yeah. yeah.
And Cannonball Run, of course, was their attempt to push Jackie Chan into North America.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
He retired in 07, and then he died on November 2nd of this year at the age of 91. So, yeah.
Yeah. So, you'd... kids, study martial arts.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, please do. So, which one should I go first? You go first. What's going to be? Well, so Big Boss was.
Why don't we arrive at Enter the Dragon? Because I find it fascinating.
Sure.
Because, and especially in light of having watched the first movie, The Big Boss. So, here's what's fascinating about The Big Boss. If you think of, you know, people's careers are not a story that they're telling you.
Yep.
Except in the case of Bruce Lee, it is. If you can view these films as a narrative of his career,
that his last movie was called Game of Death,
terrifying. And that he's dead for 4 years when it comes out, and it only features like a half an hour of pre-recorded footage of him. Game of Death is not really a Bruce Lee movie, really. Mm. But anyway, so here's the setup on The Big Boss, and I knew nothing about it because I actually thought I was watching a different movie.
Of course.
He is coming to this town from obscurity, and he has made a promise to his mother not to fight. So the movie spends at least 45 minutes with Bruce Lee in the movie not fighting.
Sure. Great way to go.
So as any kind of build up to like, how great is Bruce Lee? How about we wait half of a movie to find out, right?
Mm-hmm.
Fights are happening around him. He has an amulet his mother gave him. When he has the desire to fight, then he checks the amulet and he's like, can't fight. Until one of the bad guys, I'm sure has no symbolism at all, rips the amulet off his neck.
Whoa.
And then he gets very angry.
Oh no.
And he fights.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And the movie is only kind of okay. It's clearly a movie being made by people who are pretty new at all of this. The fight direction is not great. Lee is the only really great trained fighter in it.
Mm-hmm. Did he do the fight choreography?
It feels like he did.
Okay.
It feels like he did. But a lot of the non-Lee fight choreography is very sloppy.
Okay.
And which only serves to point out how crisp and really precise his stuff is. But it is really like a pretty flaily.
Mm.
There's a lot of like arms and legs flying around. And
sure.
It doesn't feel, and a lot of like groups fighting each other where it doesn't, there feels like there's no shape on anything. There's a lot of like shadows in the shots. It's not lit very well. It's clearly, they're working with constraints.
Yeah.
That being said, there are some genuinely funny moments in it. It veers into kind of cartoon territory at one point where like they're doing stuff. You can see they're doing stuff just to see if they can do it. It's almost to amuse themselves. There's a fight where a guy gets punched through a wall and it leaves the cutout shape of the guy.
Yep.
Behind. And I'm like, what are we doing?
Right. Yeah.
There's like knives being, at one point he picks up three knives, throws them all, they each hit a different guy square in the chest. Like stuff like that where I'm like, and they're just, there's a lot of that. Like, let's just cut from you moving your arm to a guy holding the knife in his chest, but you won't see, you know, that level of craft. Right.
Right.
But it's also like Lee is incredibly charming and the story is fine. It's, you know, it's a gangster group that owns an ice house and they're smuggling drugs inside the ice.
Great.
Frozen in the ice.
That's
brilliant,
terrific.
Right.
Yeah.
Every time anyone catches wind of it, they take them aside, offer them money. And then when that person refuses, they murder them, and then they tell everyone, oh, we don't know. I guess he left. Like,
oh,
it's the
he's
most.
He's gone now.
It is flimsy in that sense.
Tremendous.
It's a house of cards.
But, did you watch it in English?
So I did, yes.
Yeah?
So luckily enough, this was a Shout Factory release, which means they go in for a lot of extras, which is great. So I actually didn't just watch it in English. I watched it in the English dub from 1970.
That's amazing.
Yeah, because they happened to unearth it.
Yeah.
So it is, it's pretty terribly dubbed. But I thought, you know what, if I'm going to watch this.
Well, that's the thing.
I really should watch it the way people watched it in 1970, because we never watch things dubbed.
No.
And because it's not good, right? And so, it doesn't help that, like, the dubbing is what it is, and you know, but in any case, I still would recommend it. There are some really good fights in it, and it is like very instructive to see kind of how he's feeling his way around. Because by the time you get to Enter the Dragon,
Well, before we get there, how do you feel was the film well produced?
It's a funny thing to ask.
I know.
It's very loosey-goosey.
Yeah.
And so back to that thing you said about him sort of giving people money and saying, "Look, I trust you. Go do something."
Yeah.
It's definitely a broad entertainment. I think from a producer standpoint, it's a movie that's designed to make money.
Yeah.
There's nothing very heady about it. So I would say, you know, it's certainly calculated and a smart low risk project to take this guy on in, right?
Because yeah.
at that point he's kind of, he's Cato from Green Hornet, yeah. the show that ran a season and was canceled.
Right.
It's not, you know,
absolutely.
Not this a movie
is,
star.
No, this is their attempt to turn him into a valuable yeah. asset. Yeah. And it clearly worked.
You know, and a guy that had only ever been seen speaking English is now speaking Mandarin in this film, although mm-hmm. I'm watching a dub. But again, like, not, you know, I don't think he was, I don't know how big a film market there really was in Hong Kong
mm-hmm.
at the time. There clearly was some, but the movie, interestingly, the movie's not made in Cantonese, it's made in Mandarin,
mm-hmm.
Which means it wasn't really produced for Hong Kong.
For Hong Kong.
It was really right. produced for mainland China,
mm-hmm.
I assume.
Well,
right?
yeah.
You know, and so, yeah, I would say it's very hard to judge, but I think in terms of the things that Chow is obviously bringing to it, he's a very good judge of talent. I don't think mm-hmm. you discover or you know, sign up Bruce Lee and Jackie Chan and yeah. Sammo Hung in your life if you're not very good at spotting talent.
Yeah, for sure.
Right? Clearly has real taste.
Yeah.
And, you know, the movie is clunky, but it's also very clunky partly as a result of, I'm sure, very inexperienced crews. You know, you're looking at the very beginning, mm-hmm. right? So it's hard to really, it's more interesting to me what they do when they get a lot of money and success behind them later.
Yep.
So
that brings us to Enter the Dragon.
Yeah.
Which is their attempt to now create an English language movie for Bruce Lee to transition back over to the West. And I wrote an enormous number of extremely excited notes in the first 5 minutes, and then I just stopped, watched the movie,
yeah.
drank martinis.
Yeah.
And the only thing I will say specifically from that point is I wish that my longtime parallel interests in Kung Fu, in James Bond movies,
yeah.
and blaxploitation,
yeah.
had intercepted on this movie earlier.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it felt like the missing piece of some weird narrative that's been in my head since I was about 20 years old. Like, it was like, oh, yeah. this is where all the threads overlap. This is...
I'm very glad you went to James Bond right away, because that is clearly...
Oh, yeah. It is 100% a 60s Connery Bond movie done in whatever, 1972 to 1973.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that is absolutely... Like, others have said this, but it's worth, you know, repeating. The degree to which Bruce Lee is presented as an alpha male, a fully sexually confident, sexually available man, kind of in defiance of the way Asian men are presented almost entirely in Western cinema, it's so on point. It's so clear. He is so fucking attractive, so intentionally attractive. He can wear a suit like nobody I've ever seen. Yeah. And you know, and his fight work is extraordinary. There are, I mean, there were probably more. I counted two specific moments where he literally moved faster than I could see. Like, he delivered a punch where I didn't see him move.
Yeah.
I just saw the end result.
Yeah.
God knows what that would have felt like for the other guy. But, you know, like, he's just an extraordinary on-screen personality to every last detail. And the movie is a great it pulls that together in a really nice way. Oddly enough, also really, I mean, I had no idea John Saxon had a fighting history in his life, no idea. And obviously Jim Kelly as the third part of the trio, equally delightful. You know, so like just huge movie. Huge wine, huge movie. You know, like, I just was like, this is fucking great. The Schifrin score is tremendous. I downloaded it immediately.
Yeah, it's very, very good.
Yeah,
it's, and again, they get a lot of it right for an international hit. It feels very, again, this movie feels calculated.
Yes, for sure.
As a hit and in the best possible way. This is where I think Chow is a really great producer is, you know, he gets a chance to get up to the big leagues and he doesn't whiff.
Yeah.
You know, he really says, okay, well, let's do this properly.
Yeah. And it
is not a perfect movie by any means.
No, certainly not.
But man, they get so many elements.
Yeah.
So,
no. But so they, clear. Yeah, like as an access movie, again, probably intended for a Western or a worldwide audience to get in on the fun of Kung Fu, it's very well done because it does tee up the notion of the Shaolin Temple and, you know, the codes of honor and so on and so forth, but it also doesn't lean on them in an esoteric way that other audiences would find confusing. You know, one of the problems with, you know, some of the other martial arts movies that come out of that period at the time is that they are so steeped in the lore that there is a real degree to which if you are not like a studying Buddhist monk, you may not understand why character A does this at the 37-minute mark. Yeah. Whereas this, everything's very transparent. You understand sort of all of the reasons. There's I was going to say lovely. It's not lovely. It's a fight scene, and it ends in her death. But there's a great flashback scene, extended fight sequence of her of his sister fighting off a gang of thugs and then ultimately killing herself rather than being taken. Which I assume, I mean, Lee is credited as having done the fight choreography. I'm assuming he choreographed that as well. But it's another great scene. And again, a very, you know, international vernacular of how to present our motives for these characters to go off and do this thing, which also happens to take place on an island fortress in the Pacific, you know, like straight out of a James Bond movie, has, you know, scenes of quite a few scenes of beautiful women being offered to the male leads as either temptations or consorts.
Big Boss has that as well.
Yeah, I'll bet. Yeah, I'll bet. So that's, you know, that's definitely part of it. But yeah, I really had a delightful time watching that movie.
And I think, you know, overall on Chow, I think that's delightful is kind of a great way to put it. I mean, not a guy who was trying to make Schindler's List by any means.
No,
that's
no.
Okay.
Yeah, that's fine.
That kind of populist approach is fundamental to understanding, I think, you know, why these films resonate.
For sure. And I mean, and it's not like they don't also have very clear, like, language and grammatical influence on the way films are made. Like, it just takes a long time, right? Like, it's not until you get to the indie movies of the 90s that you see American filmmakers doing, you know, weird, unmotivated zooms and stuff like that, like things that they were pulling out of kinds of movies. But it gets there, and it's, you know, you can say it's just populist entertainment, and it certainly is, but it still inflects the way movie cinema is told, which is great, you know?
Yeah, and I also think, you know, as a producer, he's especially game for kind of things that you would think would be, well, for lack of a better word, too expensive.
Yeah.
So, like, the one thing I think about is, like, if you watch some of those Police Story films that he produced with Chan, mm-hmm. you know, there's no shortage of moments where you just go, that was unnecessary. That's great. You know?
Yeah.
I do think that's what he brings as a producer is that willingness to be like, you want to hoist a car in the air and then jump off of it? Yeah, okay. We'll make that work.
Well, that was one thing. I mean, just doing this, I realized kind of too late that we were both watching Bruce Lee movies, and I want to go and watch some Jackie Chan stuff. I've seen no early Jackie Chan. Like, I basically became aware of Jackie Chan when he came to the West in the 90s. So, yeah, I want to watch Police Story 1, 2, and so on. You know, get in on that.
Project A.
Will do.
Got to watch that.
Yeah, and it's been a while since I've watched a Sammo Hung movie, so I feel like I should get in on some of that too. And
remind myself. Plenty of stuff to go around.
Well, that's the thing. Like, if you actually, the funny thing about Chow is that, again, in English online media, it's almost like you can't find a complete list of his work. Like, you can, you know, obviously on the IMDb or on Letterboxd or whatever, but like, there's no page somewhere that explains, here's how he did, you know, 1974. Here's what happened, you know, in the back half of the day. Like, all that stuff is just kind of lost to time. I would really be interested in sort of like actually charting the money growth of Golden Harvest from inception to now, and sort of like how those properties were. Like, I mean, it's the Mamo in me, but it's like I just am sort of interested in how they did it. How do they come to dominate?
Yeah, let's talk about Golden Harvest for a minute, because it's a hugely influential house, and you know, I think if you watch any kind of martial arts films in the 70s, 80s, whatever, like seeing that logo come up, that is exciting.
Yeah. I mean, as much as seeing Shaw Brothers is exciting as well, you know, it's just like, Jesus, this is fun. Yeah. Good stuff. Okay. So we have not yet landed on next month's candidate. Although obviously, as we mentioned, William Goldman is certainly in the running for the December episode.
He's on that list. We'll just wait and see.
But as I said to a colleague of mine in the elevator just before we were recording, unfortunately, the problem with this show and or its greatest boon is that people just keep on dying.
Yeah.
So we'll see where we are in about a month's time. But once again, thank you so much for listening to Death Watch. You can get us in the iTunes Store and the Play Store. You can leave comments at modernsuperior.com, and we will be happy to read them if and when the email notifications come through. But if they don't, you can also shout at us on Twitter at Death Watch Pod. You can also follow us on Letterboxd at Death Watch Pod, where we will be posting watch lists every month for the person that we are going to be looking at. Anything else I've forgotten? No, I think
no,
I got it.
You didn't forget anything. You did great.
Hey, damn, man. Thanks.
I'm real proud of
you. That's nice of you to say. And then we're proud of all of you. Have a great weekend.
This episode has been brought to you by the Modern Superior Podcast Network.